Consequence Podcast Network.
This week, on the sidetrack, writer, director, producer, actor, editor, and Entertainment Tonight production assistant, Edward Burns, brings you his feature-length audio commentary of the 1983 Robert Duvall film, Tender Mercies. That's this week, on the sidetrack. Welcome back to yet another edition of The Sidetrack and yet another season of The Sidetrack. This is your host. It's me, Paul Davidson. And if you're listening to this episode first, please note there is a full episode with our full-length interview with writer, director, producer, and many more titles, Edward Burns, on the podcast feed. So don't miss it. But either way, both episodes represent our return to your ears here in season two. We had a wonderful season one. What a list of great sports. Sports is the only way I can really put it out there. Folks who have taken the time to not only record a feature-length audio commentary, which is a grind, even if you love the movie, and to also sit down for an interview with me with my somewhat random questions, but important random yet life-changing. That's how I like to think about it. Now this week, on this particular episode, Edward Burns is here to walk us through the 1983 Robert Duvall film, Tender Mercies, a film that couldn't even find a distributor at first, which is ironic because that is exactly the situation that befell one young Ed Burns as he finished his $25,000 budgeted film, The Brothers McMullen. Could not find a distributor. Eventually, as we talk about on the other episode, handed that movie to Robert Redford in an elevator after an interview at Entertainment Tonight, and the rest is history. It landed the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance in that same year and went on to spark a career that spans decades. After that, Ed went on to direct almost a new movie every 2 to 3 years that he would write, he would produce, and he would direct, and will speak at length about all of those films in their entirety on the other episode that's available now via the podcast feed. But here and now, we're talking Tender Mercies. Now, as I said, this is a film that Robert Duvall got involved with at a very early stage. He was a fan of Horton Foote, who wrote the screenplay, and it took them some time to get someone to jump on board and release this film. And even once they did, a lukewarm audience reaction spooked the studio, and it was released on 3 screens opening week, barely did much of a box office, was considered a box office failure, did about $8 million off of a $4.5 million budget. And only when the Academy Awards came calling did everything change. It was nominated for 5 Oscar nominations. Robert Duvall won Best Actor, Best Screenplay win to Horton Foote. And by that point, the film had already been released on cable and video. And so the studio's goal to re-release it into the theatrical wild was squashed at that moment. But the film has become quite a cult favorite over the years. Not even a cult favorite. I mean, this is an amazing performance by Robert Duvall. If you haven't seen it, time to watch it. You can find it on HBO Max. You can also purchase it in physical media. They're still making that, DVDs today. In any case, it's available. So get the film, cue it up, and listen to writer, director, producer, editor, and Entertainment Tonight, PA Edward Burns, with his feature-length audio commentary of Robert Duvall in Tender Mercies. Here on, yes, you guessed it, The Sidetrack.
So this is Ed Burns, and I have picked Tender Mercies as my sidetrack movie to talk about today. This is a film that I first discovered back when I was in film school, and it's part of my Texas trilogy, these 3 films set in Texas. That I fell in love with back then during film school. and continually look to for inspiration. In addition to Tender Mercies, the other two films are films based on Larry McMurtry, Larry McMurtry novel and short story, the Paul Newman film HUD, and the great Peter Bogdanovich movie, The Last Picture Show. Tender Mercies, as you can see, obviously stars Robert Duvall in a part that he was not only nominated for an Oscar, but he won the Oscar. And I believe it's the only Oscar that he's ever won. In addition to that nomination, the film received four other nominations. I believe Horton Foote, the screenwriter, was also nominated and won for his screenplay. Horton was a playwright who, I guess a couple of his films or a couple of his plays had been turned into films. I think there was a play called Tomorrow that was also made into a film in the early 70s. The film is directed by Bruce Beresford, who also had directed, or prior to this, had only, I think, directed one movie, Breaker Morant, great Australian films. And apparently this was a script that Horton wrote not with Robert Duvall in mind, but Duvall became attached immediately. They had first worked together on To Kill a Mockingbird. Horton Foote did the adaptation for that film. And obviously, I think that's Duvall's first role on screen. And apparently they had been friends ever since. And when Horton finished the script, he gave it to Duvall. Duvall became involved as a producer. And, you know, they set about trying to make the movie. One thing about this location and doing a little research about the film, you know, Beresford was apparently attracted to this part of Texas because the landscape reminded him of the outback in Australia. And one of the things that he wanted with this motel and gas station was he didn't want to be able to see any other buildings at all in the distance. Apparently, it took him a long time to find this spot, and this gas station was boarded up and closed. And when they eventually found the owner, the woman said, basically, you know, it's yours if you want it, just give me a check. The other thing that I read is apparently Beresford shot listed the entire film. And you'll see, you know, as you can just tell from this opening title sequence, the compositions are just beautiful. You know, every one of these images could be a still photograph that you would hang on the wall in your home. The other thing that you quickly take note of when watching this is Horton Foote's screenplay and Beresford's approach to the story is a less is more approach. You're only going to get the information that you absolutely need in the telling of this story of Robert Duvall's character here, Max Sledge, a drunk former country and western star who's fallen on obviously hard times, you know, wakes up in this motel, having lost a fight over a bottle of booze, has no money, and in order to pay off his debt, goes to work doing sort of these types of, you know, odd jobs here at the motel. A couple of things about the rest of the cast. These two actors here, Tess Harper and the young boy in the film, and quite honestly, I can't remember his name right now, but apparently, I mean, just look at that composition though, right there, of Duvall sitting there on the porch, just absolutely gorgeous. When Beresford was casting the film, they wanted to find someone who I guess was either from the area or felt the part, and they did an open call in Texas, and Tess had been an acting student at one of the universities down there, had never been in a film before, And this is the first film. And this is her first film. And same with the actor who plays the young boy. And I think you'll see, you know, everything about this film is understated. This film was a very big influence on me in the late 90s. I made a movie called No Looking Back about a bunch of working class kids in a seaside town. We shot in Rockaway Beach in New York in the winter. And, you know, as I'm looking at this scene here, there's a sequence in No Looking Back where I would say I'm probably shot for shot this composition. Of Tess folding laundry, the shot through the screen door of Max speaking to her. The thing that I loved about this film was how quiet it is, the silences. Beresford, as I said before, didn't feel the need to beat you over the head with these characters' backstories, exactly what they're thinking at all times, what their motivations are. I mean, just that scene right there, that moment of, will he, you know, she doesn't know this guy. Can she trust this guy? Will he give her that money that he just got? And he does it all without dialogue. And again, we go into this beautiful three shot here. We sit there silently for a while. And then very, you know, sparse, simple dialogue that tells the story. Again, this is one of my favorite scenes in the film. Reminds me of a great scene and shot in the Last Picture Show as well. You know, he plays this and that, or he opens this scene in that gorgeous big wide shot, and we track into, you know, a pretty wide two shot here, and we just sit back with the characters and let them talk. It never feels the need to go into a medium shot or go into a close up. You know, and you know, this film, again, without saying a lot, talks a lot about fathers and sons, or fathers and their children, and again, without saying too much. Again, just beautiful composition there, and another gorgeous shot here. I should say that Duvall wrote a number of these songs that he performs in the film. I'm not sure if he wrote all of them. I know the film I mentioned had 5 Academy Award nominations, in addition to the 2 wins for screenplay and for Duvall. It was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Original Song. That song was called Over You, but that wasn't one of the songs written by Duvall. It was written by Austin Roberts and Bobby Hart, and it's performed later on in the film. I was mentioning before the young boy that plays the part of Sonny was also someone that Bruce Beresford found in Texas. This young man right here. His name is Alan Hubbard. And I guess they went to a bunch of schools out in Texas to try and find a kid who had sort of that rural country vibe that they were looking for. So in addition to Tess Harper, Alan, this was his first film as well. I should mention, you know, for any aspiring filmmakers out there, there's an interesting story about this film in that, you know, you had this Horton Foote screenplay, celebrated playwright. You have Robert Duvall, massive Hollywood movie star. And they took the script around Hollywood and could not find a director for it. Apparently, every American director that they went to passed on the project. And eventually, they found Bruce Beresford, who, like I said before, Australian filmmaker, had only made one film before. But clearly the right man for the job. When you look at that beautiful composition of the establisher of the motel, I mean, just absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, and you look at this shot, you know, what I love about the choices Beresford makes in this film is, you know, that's a simple wide three shot. He lets Sonny leave, and now we're going to slowly dolly in here. And he never feels the need to move into a medium shot or a close-up of either one of these actors. And, you know, and you've got Robert Duvall on set, you know, in a performance that he not only gets nominated for, that he wins. And the confident filmmaker knows I don't need to slam my lens right up into his face. You know, what Duvall and Tess Harper are doing with their bodies says as much as the dialogue that is coming out of their mouth. Again, when he comes back, no need to go to the close-up. You know, each one of these still photographs, like I said earlier, could be a print that you would want to hang in your home. It reminds me a little bit of one of my favorite filmmakers, the Japanese filmmaker Ozu. I'll speak about him a little later. But back to the Horton Foote screenplay. Just take a look at this scene and think about how little we know about these characters so far and what's taking place here. Yeah, we've got a marriage proposal. We haven't seen any courtship. We haven't seen a love scene. We haven't even seen a kiss. And yet, you don't question it for a second. Yeah, that takes incredible confidence as a screenwriter and as a filmmaker to know that you don't need to spell it all out for the audience. Again, there's another just great simple shot, right? We've got Sonny playing catch here at school. Wide shot. He goes to take it off after the ball. Tracking shot takes us over here. You know, the bullies from school show up to talk about him. And again, you know, we talked before about, you know, one of the big themes in this film is fatherhood. Here we learn that Sonny has lost his father in Vietnam. He never knew him. And now we've already, you know, jumped ahead to the fact that Max Sledge is his stepfather already. You know, we haven't seen the wedding. We don't need to see the wedding. And again, look at this just gorgeous shot. All of that important dialogue, and we get it all there in a wide shot. Here's another example of just gorgeous, efficient filmmaking. Nothing is explained. We don't have a scene that tells us where we're going. We have the pickup there. They pull out, very similar to the shot that we saw before, the long tracking shot of Sonny at school with the kids. We're going to track along just left to right to the headstone of his father. And again, it's just very simple, beautiful dialogue that tells the story. I mean, this entire film, if you're an aspiring filmmaker who wants to make a low-budget film, a small-scale story this is a great film to look at, not just for the efficiency of the screenwriting, but, you know, Beresford's approach to coverage and composition. So now we're here at the 15-minute mark. The movie typically, you know, this is where the inciting incident of most screenwriting books will tell you should happen. And here we're going to discover, you know, who Max really is. We've got a journalist here who knows that this is Max Ledge, a former famous country and Western star. And, you know, Max has been sort of living in what a lot of screenwriters will say, the ordinary world, this new life that he's created for himself. And now that's about to get disrupted. Another one of my favorite shots. Max walks into the foreground. Reporter stays in the background. We hold on him here. You don't need to cut to the journalist back there. Movie's not about him. Stay here. Max doesn't need to say anything. Again, no acting acrobatics in this movie. Nobody screaming and yelling. No camera work that's begging you to pay attention to it. Just beautiful shot after beautiful shot. This moment here is a moment that I stole from my film, No Looking Back. I think in the third act of that film, Lauren Holly has a moment where the shit has hit the fan in her life. And instead of looking out over an empty farm field, I have her at a boardwalk in Rockaway Beach, looking out over the ocean. Again, you know, what more does Beresford need to do in that scene? It's interesting rewatching this film. I haven't seen it in a couple of years. And, you know, obviously music is a big part of the film. And they don't shy away from asking the audience to sit and listen to these tunes. You know, these aren't songs that anyone would have been familiar with. A lot of times when you see a film about a songwriter or a singer or a band, you know, you don't get to sit with the performances. So it's, I think, one of the things I always loved about this film is that, you know, they'll play these songs almost in their entirety and ask you to sit there with them. I made a film called The Groomsman years ago, and it's another film where I stole a number of moments from this scene, excuse me, from this movie. Donald Logue played a guy who used to play guitar and be a songwriter. And I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, this composition here of him with the guitar was a shot that we stole in that film. You'll also see later on, there's a great moment with Robert Duvall when he sings a song called On the Wings of a Dove that we stole or paid homage to in The Groomsman. But again, the thing that I keep coming back to with this film is the composition and the efficiency in the filmmaking. I mean, there's just a gorgeous three shot here with Tess in the background watching. You know, he'll cut to the single of Duvall and the kid maybe once, but you know, it's he understands it's not necessary. So anyhow, we come in here. This is a group of musicians from a band who found out that Max Sledge is staying here. Kind of interesting thing. I'm sure the production design team, there was no accident that everything in these compositions here are the sort of red, white, and blue. You notice the red and white van, the red and white sign behind them, the red and white Coca-Cola machine, the ring bell service, the gas and oil sign, there's a mobile home in the background, and for the most part, you know, our band is wearing blue. A uniquely American story. I'm sure many of you have seen the Jeff Bridges movie Crazy Heart, and I didn't do any research to find out if the filmmaker was at all influenced by this film, but I'd have to imagine he was. You know, the story of a country singer-songwriter who, world of talent, became a drunk, lost it all, and as you'll see, there's a journey, a redemptive journey that Max is on that, if I remember correctly, in the Jeff Bridges film, the Jeff Bridges character goes on as well. The thing about this film, which is interesting, and you know, I'll comment on it as we go, and it has, you know, it's all about Horton Foote's script and how he doesn't give you either what you expect or what you've come to expect from watching so many films, or maybe even what you want. What you crave. Case in point, this scene here. This young band has come to meet their hero, and I'll let it play for you. But again, just take note of the composition. This gorgeous, gorgeous, simple shots. Right, Beresford and his editor choose to hold on this wide shot for this long. You know, I'm sure the studio heads were in that editing room begging him to cut to some close-ups of their big movie star. And, you know, he gives you some coverage here, but, you know, he held back on that wide shot for quite some time. And there you go. Sound advice. Sing it the way you feel it. You know, again, for aspiring screenwriters, filmmakers, you know, years ago, I was talking to a musician friend of mine. We're talking about a film I had made, a tiny little movie called Nice Guy Johnny. And he said something about, I think the expression he used was, own your tone. And it kind of reminds me of that line, sing it the way you feel it. Like, you've got to trust your gut as a writer and a filmmaker, whether you're writing songs, screenplays, you have to find your voice and hopefully let it come from the heart. So this is Betty Buckley, Broadway star. Don't really know much about what kind of film career she had prior to this, but I think primarily she was known as a Broadway star. She was not a country western star at all. Again, another example of, if you are watching this movie, are they going to ask you to sit back and enjoy the tunes? Obviously Betty Buckley has an incredible voice. So it's not hard to do. And and this next song here that she performs might be familiar to some folks. This is the one that won the, or was nominated for the Academy Award. So I figured I'd sit back and let you enjoy that tune. Obviously, I'm sure you recognize Wilford Brimley here. I guess the Vol wanted Brimley cast in the film. They were good friends, old friends. I've read in doing some of the research that I guess Duvall and Beresford did not get along that well during the making of the film. And Duvall wanted... a buddy down on set with him, somebody who would be on his side. Brimley's, always terrific. It's interesting, I always felt that moment there where Duvall looks to the cop and then we see him coming inside, that a scene must have been left on the cutting room floor. Maybe the cop wasn't the greatest actor, or maybe they felt like they wanted to speed it along. But an interesting thing, you know, the film's running time is something like 95 minutes, which for a big Hollywood film, unfortunately, you never see 95-minute movies anymore. You know, we're asked to sit through two-hour-plus films, which I can remember as a young filmmaker when I was making my first film, Brothers McMullen, our first cut was 2 hours long. And as I was getting the movie ready for Sundance, Ted Hope, my producer, was encouraging me to try and cut about 15, 20 minutes out of the movie. And he had a great movie. He says, you know, most people... when they leave the theater, they'll always say, oh, that movie was too long. There was that 20 minutes in the middle. But you never hear anyone say, oh, you know, that movie was a little too short. And we eventually got that movie down to 95 minutes as well. And again, you know, we've got a pretty small, simple story here that probably didn't need any more than 95 minutes, especially when you consider, as I said before, the efficiency of the screenplay. So Max returns home after seeing that he, not quite sure what he expected, and coming up is really one of my favorite scenes in the film. Again, it's pretty simple. It's a joy to watch a great actor like Duvall do his thing and play the very subtle highs and lows in this next scene with Tess Harper. It's probably one of the longest dialogue scenes in the film. Even just seeing this shot here, it's another shot that I stole in No Looking Back of Lauren Holly ironing. And I think the Jon Bon Jovi character comes in. The location we had was very similar to this sort of layout with the two doors. And I'm pretty sure we knocked this shot and blocking off for a scene in that film. You know, again, hats off to the production designer in this film. If you look at that set, it feels completely authentic. And at the time, and I don't know if the scenes were actually shot inside that motel, or if this was a stage, or if they found another location. But you absolutely feel the age of this space. And I can assure you that is that can be very difficult to do. I'm sure all of you have seen films where it's supposed to have sort of a rural look or a beat up look, and you know, the appliances look a little too new, and there isn't any sort of wear and tear on the cabinets or the door frames. Not the case here. So like I was saying earlier, one of the longest dialogue scenes in the movie, and we're at the 32-minute mark, and we're finally getting some insight into Max's history and what his relationship was like with his wife and the fact that he's got a daughter and he was divorced and he hadn't seen her. Heartbreaking scene here where Brimley comes to tell him that the song isn't any good. Again, another gorgeous shot. If it isn't obvious already, I love the wider compositions that Beresford gives us in this film. Yeah, they do such a great job in telling the story. You're taking in all of that environment. He doesn't feel the need to fly the camera in. And even in a moment like this, a lot of times, you know, the filmmaker might make the choice here to slowly track in on their two faces during this sort of intimate moment where they're connecting. But, you know, Beresford understands that's not at all necessary. Again, another one of my favorite scenes in the film. Tess goes to retrieve the guitar, and you're, you know, again, maybe in a different movie, one where maybe too many studio execs got their hand in the making of it, we'd hear Duvall sing this song, and we would recognize it immediately as a brilliant tune that his ex-wife and his former friend and manager should have recognized as such, and we as the audience would say, oh, wow, Max Sledge, he really must have been something terrific. But as you can see, it's, you know, I don't want to say it's a bad song, but even Max can't find it in him to finish it. So Max, frustrated, takes off. Interesting, I just noticed that the pickup truck is green. Door frame is green. I don't know if you noticed that. Kitchen, green. So in addition to sort of the red, white, and blue color palette they played with the exterior, green truck, you know. And a lot of times, you know, filmmaker is production designer and then your costume designer. We'll all work together and discuss a color palette, you know, make obvious choices as to sort of what's the general palette and when do you want a color to pop against it. Green and red again. Doesn't happen by accident. So the boys are back. So there's a number of interesting little facts and trivia that I dug up in preparing for this. One of the things I didn't realize, you know, I mentioned the Jeff Bridges film earlier, Crazy Heart, which has obvious similarities, alcoholic country western singer who then goes on to a journey of redemption. Apparently Duvall, I had forgotten that, you know, he appeared in the movie, but also produced that. So interesting little connection between the two films. I guess one of the, when the film initially tested with test audiences, it did not test very well at all. And, you know, I guess the studios did not know how a film about a drunken country western star would play. They didn't quite know if there was any audience for it, and then coupled with the fact that it did not test well. The film opened in March of 83 in only three theaters, one in New York, one in LA, and one in Chicago. You know, for anyone who's really familiar with the, let's say, you know, the indie film scene of the last 30 years, That's kind of the typical release for any indie film. You know, you open usually in New York, LA. It's called a platform release. And then depending on how you do there, they add screens in the next five markets. If you do well there, they add a few more screens and you go wide. And with the idea being, if you get, a decent per screen average, you know, people showing up at those initial screenings, but also if you get some really strong reviews, that then justifies the studio putting more money into it. And that's kind of become the standard go-to release for a lot of the prestige indie movies. I think I didn't know was, you know, when this was released in 83, you know, that indie scene, it predates that indie scene, but this film is kind of credited with being an early American independent movie. Not just because of how it was released, you know, again, it was a studio film, but the release was comparable to, you know, what indie films do. But more so for its storytelling. You know, it is a, this is a character film. There is no high concept here. There are no easy laughs in this thing. There are no slapstick moments. It is just a small personal story about folks going through the day-to-day hardships, this couple right here, Tess and her boy, Sonny, dealing with a father who was lost in Vietnam. Max Les, a drunk who has lost his way. These are all sort of, for most folks, very relatable. Apparently, the studio that released it was Universal. And I guess, in 1983, they had another big film coming out starring Duvall's Godfather co-star, Al Pacino. And that film was Scarface. And that was the movie that Universal was apparently putting all their money behind. I guess when some country music stars like Willie Nelson saw the film, they fell in love with it and I guess helped promote the film. And that was part of, I guess, how the film eventually was able to get an audience and then find its way, to all those Academy Awards and apparently a number of Golden Globe opportunities as well. You know, this is a moment where, in most films, the filmmaker most likely would have put a piece of music behind these moments, a bit of score to help help sell the emotion of the moment. And apparently Beresford had a score composed for the film, put it in, and then didn't like it, thought maybe it was a little too sappy or took away from the authenticity of what he was trying to do and pulled it out. So the only music you'll hear through the film are the needle drops from jukeboxes and radios. Sorry about that. That's my dog. And also obviously the performances that we see. So this next sequence is one of my favorites in the film. Mac has returned. We're not quite sure if he's gone on a bender or not. But I'll let you watch it. It's just beautiful acting by the two of them. So again, for any aspiring filmmakers, it's interesting when you look at Beresford's approach to his coverage. You know, we see Max walk into this room in a very simple wide shot. The camera does not move at all. We've got this single of Duvall and the single of Tess. She's in a medium shot. He's more in a medium close-up. And unlike, you know, most films today, you know, this camera does not move. You know, it looks like here as Tess moves about the kitchen, the camera's probably just on a tripod, panning left and right. Here he allows her to step into something of a close-up. But, you know, the camera on Duvall never moves at all. And we play a simple single and another single. And again, as they move into the bedroom and she moves in and he sits down on the bed to show her some of these songs he's written. Just, you know, again, if you're trying to make your independent or lower budgeted movie, you know, part of the thing you have to do is you've got to work on a tight schedule. You're trying to make your movie as efficiently as you can, which means as quickly as you can, which means in as few days as you can. And every day costs a lot of money. If you spend the day shooting multiple angles and different sizes over and over again of the same scene, obviously you're not going to get much of your movie made in one day. And there are plenty of filmmakers who have big budgets who do that. But take a look at this. You know, you don't need any more than what you're seeing to tell the story. And a story like this doesn't need that camera flying all over the place. So many times you'll see the filmmaker gets in the way of the story. Again, beautiful, simple compositions. You know, the bed frame in the foreground of both shots. We don't need to cut to the kid in a close-up. I hate to beat a dead horse on this, but every time I watch the film, I'm just reminded of a lot of times less is more. So Duvall here is singing one of the five songs that he sings in the film. I mentioned before, he wrote a number of the songs. This is not one that he wrote. The two songs that he wrote were Fool's Waltz and I've Decided to Leave Here Forever. This song, If You Hold the Ladder, I got quite honest, I don't know who was written by. So here we are at the midpoint of the movie, and it's the first kiss we see between the two of them. The old studio system, you know, they're certain guidelines for sort of, let's say, traditional Hollywood narratives. And, sorry, it's my dog again. And there was an old saying that you had sex at 60, which was basically at the midpoint of a two-hour movie, 60-minute mark, the main couple would have to have a kiss or have sex. So even in a little film like this, we've got some form of sex at 60. Again, you know, if you're a filmmaker and you want to look at some composition, we had sort of a slightly longer lens shot of the gang here, six of them walking down the street. Simple shot as they're kind of coming towards camera, no coverage. We walk into the feed store. He takes us in on the right side of frame, a little bit of a dolly and a pan to take him through. Now we're holding a big wide shot for this walk and talk here. track late in the street, probably not a Steadicam, especially in 1983. And here he finally cuts into a slightly tighter shot, probably on the same bit of track, threw a longer lens on. We pop back out to this. Again, very simple coverage. And the nice thing about, you know, Beresford's use of these wide shots is you really get a sense of place, you know, where we've now moved into the second half of the movie. And this is really the first time that we get out into the world, you know. So I had to interrupt myself there because that moment is one of the famous lines in the film, and apparently Horton Foote was inspired to write this. I think maybe he had a son or a son-in-law who was in the music biz. And that's where the country western music business, and that's where the initial idea came to him. And then he met an older former country star. I got more interested in that guy's story, and that's where the story came from. And while he was having lunch with that star, a woman came up to him and said that very line. Again, I love these kind of shots right here. You know, the frame within the frame. I mentioned the Japanese filmmaker Ozu that I loved. Ozu was famous for these kind of static frame within a frame shots. So, the great Ellen Barkin appears. Typically, you know, if you're going to abide by sort of classic Hollywood structure, a three-act structure, you know, this part of the movie after the, you know, we're still in the second act, but we've come through the midpoint. Some people will call this section, you know, bad guys close in or, you know, further complications. You know, we're basically, what you want to do is you want to raise the stakes for our hero. Typically in this part of a screenplay, this part of a movie, the scenes will start to get a little shorter. At least that's what some people abide by. This is Ellen Barkin's second film. I believe the first film, her first film was Diner. So this is a pretty incredible 1-2 punch to start your career with. Diner is another one of my favorites. And, you know, I've mentioned a film I made years ago called The Groomsman, which was very much inspired by Diner, also inspired by a great smaller Fellini movie, Il Vitellini. You know, stories of young men in their 20s preparing for a friend to get married. But anyhow, the reason I mention The Groomsman here is, as I said, there are a number of moments, I should say, there are a number of compositions and shots that Beresford and his cinematographer I felt inspired by it to put in. But this moment coming up here, going to interrupt just for a second here. You know, you either like these kinds of films or you don't. You know, when you think about, you know, being a filmmaker and having a style, there's something, again, just so simple in Beresford's approach. You know, we're playing almost this entire scene, obviously a very emotional scene, in two shots, in two very simple shots. And there are no fireworks going off from either one of the actors because there's no need for it. A lot of times you'll work with actors if you are a filmmaker or want to be a filmmaker, and then sometimes you've got to talk to the actors that it isn't about the acrobatics, if you will. You know, that less is more approach is just really terrific, as you're getting to see. Again, take a look at this gorgeous shot here. I mean, come on. How great is that moment? How heartbreaking. You can see why I tried to create a moment like that in one of my films, and I am sure I will try again. And again, you know, Bruce Beresford's approach on that. He sits back in that wide shot. He never cuts to the close-up of Duvall. And Duvall not only gets nominated, but he wins the Academy Award. I don't know that a performance like this that's so understated, that isn't slammed up into your face, gets that kind of recognition today. Because, you know, films like this, not only do they not get made, but we seem to have fallen out of love with this style of storytelling. I should mention Russell Boyd, the cinematographer. I've mentioned him a couple of times. And don't really know much about him, but as you can tell, I'm an enormous, enormous fan of his work in this film. Interestingly, apparently both of these guys, Brimley and Duvall, had a problem with Beresford's approach. You know, I've gone on and on about, and again, this scene here is a perfect example of the simplicity to his approach. Two static singles. I think we had that one wide shot, and that's been about it. And I think I mentioned also that he storyboards the entire film. So he goes into each scene basically knowing exactly what he wants his compositions to be. Apparently Duvall didn't love to work that way. He wanted a little bit more freedom. He wanted to sort of, I guess, explore the scenes a little bit more than Beresford wanted to. So they had some heated disagreements on set with apparently Beresford at one point walking off set. But later on, when they both spoke about the film, they talked about the, I guess, their two different approaches, their two different personalities. The film ended up somewhere in the middle, and obviously we're the better for it. Interesting. One of the few moments here that I'm noticing where camera's on track. And now we're pushing in here on Mac. Interesting. Curious why at that moment, there was also a slight camera move on Tess Harper at the, wherever she was, the bathroom of that motel room. So, you know, one of the big themes in the film is redemption. Clearly, Mac's journey towards redemption and Christianity is a big part of the film. We've seen Tess singing in the choir a couple of times. We've seen her say her prayers at night. I don't know if you noticed the hands in prayer on the wall when Max is singing the Wings of a Dove song. And now, obviously, we've got a baptism. right, so Mac on his journey to redemption. I mean, how terrific is this kid? First movie, never acted before, and he's working opposite the great Robert Duvall. Apparently, they became fast friends, and Duvall even taught him how to play guitar. And I guess to this day, he, Alan the actor, became a guitar teacher, and I think I read that he owns a guitar shop in Texas and still has the guitar that Duvall gave him. So Roger Ebert said in his review of the film that Tender Mercies isn't simply about country singers, it's about country songs. It's notable that Beresford doesn't cut away after a few establishing lyrics, but stays to listen. Country Western is about the stories it tells, which is why you can always understand the lyrics, and the stories are windows into the heart. Duvall himself performs a couple, and Buckley as Dickley sings "The Nominated Over You" is what makes her blah blah blah. It's one of the things that I was always impressed with the film, not just Duvall's singing, but the fact that they ask us to sit there in these honky tonks and in these bars and in the kitchen and really sit back and listen to these tunes. Pretty great, huh? Even if you don't like country music, that was wonderful. So we're approaching the 70-minute moment in the film, and things seem to be looking up for Max Ledge. All right, the road to redemption seems to maybe be complete. He's got his girl. He's back singing. He's been baptized. terrific scene between those two young actors. And again, you know, the entire, the journey of this family, Tess, young Sonny, and Mac. Obviously, redemption for all of them, all doing well. Again, you know, just take notice of two things. The compositions, that entire scene, low angle, wide shot. And now we've got this wide shot of Ellen Barkin, a little bit of a camera move here. But again, I go back to the Horton Foot screenplay. You know, we never see the courtship between Mac and Tess Harper. We never see their wedding. And now we discover that our hero, our country western star, has recorded a new album, and we don't see it. I mentioned the filmmaker Ozu. That was one of the things that he would do. Most of his films would revolve around a family. And the stories that took place, let's say the subplots that took place outside of the family's life, weddings, funerals, he would not include those. You know, we'd see the family at home in their house discussing, let's say, the daughter's wedding. And then we would see them afterwards when they were back home. And that sort of minimalist approach to storytelling and filmmaking, I'm a big fan of. And I'm obviously Beresford and Horton Foote clearly like that approach as well. Again, Beresford's approach. So far, this scene is one shot. We have Wilford Brimley here. Doesn't even give him a close-up of any kind. We never see his eyes. Don't need to. Subtle little thing. You know, we talk about things improving in Mac's life. First time we see customers at the motel. If you notice, as the van pulled in, there's a couple coming out of one of the rooms and getting into their cars. And now we've got good news as well. So we've got 15 minutes left in the movie. the end of the second act is happening right here. And watch how Horton Foote and Beresford handle this moment. In a lot of screenwriting books, that moment is called the all is lost moment. The good times are over. The hero is dealt a severe blow, usually a death. And he's got to face the dark night of the soul, the moment where our hero has to make a decision as he goes into the third act. How does he handle this setback? Does it cripple him? Does it kill him? Does it prevent him from finishing the journeys on? Or does he find the strength to move forward? So now we have a scene of Max arriving at Betty Buckley's house. With another one of Duvall's songs playing as he enters. Again, we have the wide shot that takes Duvall up the stoop and into the house. Another wide shot in the front hallway. And now a two shot that takes us in and we'll hold here. Three shots, three setups, camera never moves. Cuts to the close-up for that moment. And that's it. Again, you can imagine another filmmaker having tears, throwing himself on the coffin, maybe singing the Wings of a Dove song, but that is not what Horton Foote and Beresford were up to. So Mac comes in to see Betty Buckley, after the death of their daughter. It's interesting, in that shot we just saw of Mac look like a flag used to cut some light may have been left in the frame. If you rewind that, take a look at the left side of your screen. I don't have much to say about this scene other than to repeat some of the things I've said before about the compositions and, again, the simplicity to the approach. One thing that's different about this scene, the entire film, as we've discussed, is so understated. And this is sort of the only time in the film where an actor is given the opportunity to sort of show, actually, I guess, any emotion. If you think back to almost every other big turning point these characters have had, other than maybe the opening scene when a drunken Max Sledge is, which we don't see, right? We see that through the window in that opening shot. It's one of the only times that somebody raises their voice in the film. I'll let you watch it. We'll pick it up on the other side of the scene. And again, that was it. Not even that big of an emotive moment. Or I should say, it doesn't let it play out longer than it needs to be. So again, this scene, just one of my absolute favorites. Take a look at it. Listen to how Foote wrote it and how Beresford treats it. Great, great courage as a filmmaker. I don't trust happiness. I never did and I never will. It's probably the most famous line from this film. A little bit of the Ozu, frame within the frame, simple pan there. Keeps the door jammed in the shot. Camera stays back. Take Sonny all the way in, take Sonny all the way out. again. I did not love moments like that. So obviously the one of the major themes Hortonfoot is playing with here is fatherhood. You know, Sonny loses his father, doesn't know much about him, and even his mother doesn't seem to know that much about him. This kid thinks he's going to grow up without a dad until Mac, a failed father, shows up in his life. Mac here at the end of our story gets a second chance. And again, everything about it is just subtle and simple. Beresford tracks in here, one of the only little dolly shots. Alrighty. Well, I hope that was interesting. I have to admit that was a little tougher to do than I thought it was going to be. I'm glad I picked a film that was only 95 minutes long. Any aspiring filmmakers out there, or anyone who's made a film and trying to figure out how to make another one on a much lower budget, it's a great film to study. As I said, economy and storytelling, economy and approach. I hope that was helpful. I hope it was enjoyable. I'm Ed Burns, and that was Tender Mercies.
Big thanks, big shout out to Ed Burns for taking the time to walk us through Tender Mercies. All the stats are at the front of this episode. You don't need me to tell you the year who produced it. It's all in there. As always, we will be back next week. And the week beyond that, and the week beyond that, and so forth, as we chart our path through this second season here at the Sidetrack. I want to thank everyone for listening. And of course, remember the 3 R's of podcasting success. Rate, review, and retweet. Please spread the word. Let your friends know. And when you're sitting down with your 75-year-old mother, play her an episode. She just might dig it. We'll see you next week. Thanks again for joining us here on the Sidetrack. Thank you.